Genesis 6, 1-4 reads as follows. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of the gods saw that the daughters of humans were beautiful, and they married any of them that they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with humans forever, for they are corrupt, and their days will be 120 years." The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterwards, when the sons of the gods went to the daughters of humans and had children by them, they were the heroes of old, men of renown. This is one sermon project that I almost wished I'd never started. I told you I was going to talk about this, so I kind of had to. There are many unanswered questions in this passage, and of course, the fundamentalists will have absolutely no difficulty at all imagining that some level of divine or semi-divine beings had relations with human women and gave birth to super babies or humans with magical powers because, well, anything is possible with God. But today I'll attempt to answer two simple questions. Who were the Nephilim? Were they real or were they mythological? If they were real, where did they go? And are there any of those left today? Secondly, what important lessons were the readers of Genesis expected to learn and draw from this bizarre biblical reference? First, let me just answer an obvious question. Why even bother to make a sermon out of some obscure reference to characters that we know so little about and are mentioned so few times? How is this a sermon material? And the simple answer is because it's in the Bible. And we would expect that everything written and preserved in the scriptures has a good reason to be there. In fact, the brief account of the Nephilim provide us with an important window into the beliefs and worldview of the Jewish people of the intertestamental period. Let's begin by examining this passage in Genesis 6 that I started with, before looking at other common Jewish literature that referenced the Nephilim. When human beings began to increase in number on the earth, and daughters were born to them, the sons of the gods... In Hebrew, it is B'nai Elohim. Elohim is the plural word of the Hebrew word for God, Eloah. When the sons of the gods, or if you prefer, the sons of God, when they saw that the daughters of men, so you're talking about two different species of beings, humans and sons of God, who were not human, as these are referenced to the daughters of men, when they saw that they were beautiful, they married any of them that they chose. At this point, the actions of the sons of the gods are neutral. We might think it is bizarre for divine or semi-divine or spirit beings marrying and having relationships with humans, but nothing indicates that this is bizarre in the text. What is harmful, at least from our cultural perspective, is that, first of all, the human girls did not choose the sons of the gods and had no voice in the partnership. This was not an equal union. They hadn't fallen in love with each other. They were selected like one might select a new vehicle from a showroom. But that is how human men of this period also selected a human wife as well. Secondly, the sons of the gods had a pick of wives before and ahead of the sons of men, regular humans. So there's clearly a sense of what I would call hyper-dominance and oppression here, which may partially account for God's anger. Now, as an aside, it's important to bear in mind that population density is a major contributing factor to tension and the rise of violence in ancient societies, either because the population density is too high, too much overcrowding, or because it's too low and people fear extinction of their tribe or of their people group. The number of Jewish people returning from the Babylonian exile during the time that Genesis was compiled, it was written in pieces, in sections, earlier than this, but it was compiled when they came back from the Babylonian exile. The number of Jewish people returning was approximately 42,000 people. But they, along with their northern Israelite cousins, had previously numbered as many as 5 million, based on the census that King David conducted. So to account for this tiny number of Jewish survivors, the author seems to be suggesting that God was not pleased with the earlier group because of immorality and unfaithfulness, a common theme in all of the prophets. And he chose to eliminate a large portion of his people through war and exile. The cause of this immorality, then, must have been deception and infiltration and being led astray by spiritual beings and forces, possibly of a semi-divine nature. And the myth of the Nephilim is one way of accounting for how this might have happened that led to this huge decrease in their population. Continuing in Genesis 6, the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend or fight or argue or harangue with humans forever. They are corrupt, and I will limit their days to 120 years old." As we'll see later during the time of the Tower of Babel and the time of Noah and the flood, God is quite often portrayed as being fed up with his human creation and wishes to start again by destroying almost everyone. But for now, as punishment for behaving in such a harmful and destructive manner, God limits the length of the average human life, or the top end of human life, to 120 years. We aren't told what it was before this, but supposedly humans, in other references, could live to be almost 1,000 years old. So it would seem that the longer people live, the more ways they find to distort the will of God for their lives, and the more creative they become in replacing God with immoral pursuits. One other point before we move on. The passage reads, "The Lord said, My spirit will not contend with humans forever." The Lord said. Anytime you see that statement in the scriptures, you reasonably can ask, who heard him say that, whatever it was that the Lord said? Who was talking with God? This statement is clearly written as a quote. Someone claims to have heard these words come from the mouth of God. The author is, in a sense, reporting on what God said. But who heard him say that? Who was God chatting with about his frustrations with humans? Well, this is just another indication that we're reading theological mythology, not a journalistic first-hand account of something that was said or something that happened. And then, almost as if the reader is expected to be fully familiar with these strange beings and the tales about them, the author of Genesis casually introduces us to a brand new group of characters. And it just, for the first time these are mentioned, just drops in, "Oh, and the Nephilim were on the earth in those days." Oh yeah, the Nephilim, yeah, we remember them. Meaning that they used to live on the earth, but they're no longer with us. So this passage answers one of the questions today. No, there's no more Nephilim. They were in those days, they're not in today's day. "And when the sons of God went to the daughters of humans, they had children by them." So who were the Nephilim? Genesis gives us the answer. They were the heroes of old, men of renown. Not ordinary men, special men. In other words, these are the, you might say, larger-than-life individuals featured in ancient myths. We might equate them to myths about the Viking Redbeard, or the giant lumberjack and folk hero Paul Bunyan, or William Tell, Robin Hood, King Arthur, people like that. But these Nephilim are way more than human folk heroes. They are particularly giants whose identity we will see later on may have been fallen angels or demigods or a specially developed race of superhumans that are no longer around. Now again, we're talking mythology here. There have been no bones of Nephilim found, no men with little wings, because they were kind of angels, but not really angels, or special features like that. And in the case, in case this seems to you a little far-fetched, and it does, remember that Genesis was written in a time when talk of giants and angelic beings walking the earth and superhuman individuals and demigods was not uncommon. We don't talk about these kind of things today. We would find these things unusual, but not at the time Genesis was compiled. And furthermore, even though there's few biblical references to them, the Nephilim are not some isolated, best left alone biblical characters, because we don't have a clue what they were. And perhaps we're afraid to find out, because maybe it'll make the Bible sound a little too fantastical. On the contrary, the Nephilim were common in Jewish literature of the time, so we can best understand them by not searching the scriptures to find out the few references, but by looking laterally to all of the contemporary literature that referenced them to understand what people thought about these beings. We've got to back up a little bit first, though. It has long been known by Jewish scholars that the earliest followers of Yahweh, from Abraham to about the time of Isaiah, believed that there were many gods. They just believed that Yahweh was the ultimate, the highest. In Hebrew, he's called El Elyon, which means higher in vertical position in heaven above the other gods, who were above angelic beings, who were above humans. And definitely the most powerful. We see that even in the Ten Commandments, where the Israelites are instructed to have no other gods. But if there aren't any other gods, they wouldn't be told to have no other gods. They would be told there is only one God, so there's nothing else that can be considered a god. But the instruction is specifically, you shall have no other gods before me, or ahead of me, or more predominant than me. It was assumed that there were other gods, because every society, every tribal people group said they had gods. So there was no reason, since no one saw any of their gods, there was no reason to disbelieve anyone's claims. But none of these were to be worshipped. That was the key factor. Full monotheism didn't begin until Isaiah's time. The first biblical reference we have to absolute monotheism, that is, there is only one God, and anyone else who claims to be God is making it up. The first clear statement is Isaiah 44, verse 6, where it reads, I am the first, and I am the last, and besides me there is no God. The term Nephilim comes from the Hebrew word nephal, which means fallen or to fall. So these were either those who fell on their enemies, is one possible explanation, because they were giants, because they were powerful, because they were enormously militaristic, or another explanation is that they had fallen far from God, morally speaking, and they were evil. But other than a passing reference to the Nephilim being in the land of Canaan, when the spies were sent out to check out the land to see if it was habitable for the Israelites, and the reports came back and said, I don't think we can go in there because there are Nephilim in there, and we're scared of those big, possibly hairy dudes. with giant spears and big swords, and we're not going in there and tackling those guys. But other than those two references, there's no further information about them in the First or the Second Testament. But other Jewish scriptures and mythology have much more to say about the subject. And although the material is not considered, quote-unquote, inspired or authorized by the Orthodox Church, with the main exception being the Ethiopian Christians, who still accept this set of scriptures, this information still represents what Jews before the time of Jesus thought about the Nephilim. And our best source of information about the Nephilim comes from the apocryphal book of Enoch, which was written about 300 years before the time of Jesus. And that book is accepted by many Christians, not most Orthodox, but as I said, the Ethiopian Christians have this as part of their Bible. In fact, Enoch was not included in the Bible, mostly because of its description of fallen angels and Nephilim, and because those uncomfortable characters were causing so much tension among fellow Christians that the book was left out of the canon for primarily the reason that it was causing too much debate. The Book of Enoch contains unique material on the origins of demons and Nephilim, where they came from, why some angels fell from heaven, and they didn't just fall morally, they fell to earth and live with us, an explanation of why the Genesis flood was morally necessary, along with a prophetic exposition of the thousand-year reign of the Messiah. After the return of Judah from the Babylonian captivity, as I alluded to earlier, the Jews struggled mightily. They tried and failed to build the temple, and they were continually being dominated by foreign forces. And once again, the Jewish leadership needed to understand this in order to stop it from keep happening. And so they attributed this lack of greatness, since they were promised greatness from the time of Abraham, since they expected greatness, this lack of greatness and blessing was attributed to the sinfulness of the people. And their sinfulness, it was suggested, as I already alluded to, was not entirely their fault. It was attributed to fallen angels or demons who had infiltrated God's people and were possessing them and poisoning their minds and leading them to rebel against God. So what is referred to as the intertestamental period, that's the 400 to 500 years before the time of Jesus, saw a greatly increasing emphasis on monotheism, the urgent need for a Messiah, and a frantic search for exactly how to keep the law perfectly and properly in a way that would be pleasing to God and cause him to return to bless and save and rescue his people. This was a time of purification of the Jews. It was a time of finding some way to be faithful enough to God to avoid losing their Jewish soul, their Jewish identity and independence, and even their religion after 70 years in exile in Babylon, followed by the domination of the Persians, followed by the Greeks, followed by the Romans. And this led, as you might expect, to groups of very devoutly religious people, such as the Pharisees and the Zealots. And it resulted in several failed Jewish wars to eradicate the Holy Land of Gentile overseers. But even more importantly, it was a time of development and expansion of the theology that Yahweh was not just the Most High God, looking down on many other inferior gods, but that there were no other gods. But with monotheism comes a major problem. When you have many gods, you typically have good gods, you have the most holy, righteous, perfect Yahweh, and then other gods are not such good gods, and they're responsible for all the bad things that happen in your life. But if you have only one God, how do you explain evil in the world? Who do you attribute I'm going to go with that. You just made up a new word. Who do you attribute bad things to? Who's responsible? It can't be lowly humans. We're not that important in the universe. And so monotheism comes with this troubling dilemma. If God is good, and there are no bad gods to blame things on, then how do we explain evil in the world? God cannot both be perfectly righteous and simultaneously cause harm and do evil. And that is what triggered the flourishing of ideas of a sub-level of divine beings. Not gods, not humans, but created beings who were spirit or spirit-human hybrids who routinely interacted in the human world. And this led to a complex teaching of fallen angels, watchers, headed by an adversary, a Satan, a devil, known as Azazel, along with other names. And the pinnacle of fallen angel experience, whether that's sons of God or sons of the gods, was found in the act of intercourse between human females and angels, because it would appear all angels must identify as male. And the offspring of these unions would handily explain the existence of tribes and peoples who did not look and act like everyone else. It was a reasonable explanation for people groups who were taller, more athletic, more aggressive and warrior-like, people such as the Anak, which I won't get into today. And the point of most mythical accounts in the First Testament, whether we're talking about sea monsters, talking donkeys, or large fish that swallow God's prophets, is to look at what God is doing and what is he telling his people, usually some kind of warning, some kind of explanation of a difficult theological concept such as grace, or simply encouragement to remain faithful. And in the case of the Nephilim, the warning is as follows, and the message is this, that no matter how powerful you are as a nation, you, as humans, no matter how dominant you may be as a species, Yahweh is still more powerful. Secondly, he will not tolerate those who ignore him or take advantage of what you may call his suffering fools for a while. In the end, no one gets away with disobedience and unfaithfulness. Thirdly, those who are faithful to God never need to worry about forces, human or divine, and armies and political powers that seem overwhelming. With God on your side, any foe, any enemy can and will eventually be defeated. And I'll close with this, as Paul would later write. This is the heart and core of the message of the people we refer to as the Nephilim. In Romans chapter 8, verses 38 to 39, Paul writes, "For I am convinced that neither death nor life, nor angels, nor Nephilim, nor demons, neither the presence of anyone now or in the future, nor any powers, neither height nor depth nor anything else in all creation will be able to separate us from the love of God that is in Christ Jesus our Lord."